The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Camilla Balich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education. What reports has he seen about trends in training and apprenticeships?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, good news. I've seen the latest figures from the very successful Apprenticeship Boost Initiative, part of our COVID-19 support initiatives that have been helping to keep helping employers to keep their early stage apprentices employed and in training. 18,507 employers have now been engaged. 26,000 apprentices are currently eligible for an apprenticeship boost payment, and in total 49,000 apprentices have so far benefited from the scheme. As part of this year's budget, apprenticeship boost has now been extended through to December next year.
Supplementary. Is the overall number of apprentices increasing, and if so, by how much?
Mr. Speaker, even more good news. I'm advised that there are now 56,965 active apprentices. That's a 61% increase on June 2019 prior to the pandemic, and a 90% increase since June 2017. Vocational education, Mr. Speaker, is back on the map and it is thriving in New Zealand.
What information has he received on other vocational COVID support initiatives that the government has put in place?
Mr. Speaker, as a temporary measure until the end of this year, we put in place free vocational training and apprenticeships under the Targeted Training and Apprenticeships Fund. The latest enrolment data shows that 215,375 people have been supported through that fund since July of 2020. That includes 98,000 apprentices. The Targeted Training and Apprenticeships Fund makes a range of qualifications in targeted areas and all apprenticeships free until the 31st of December this year. It is another example of the real work that this government is doing to tackle the skill shortages that we inherited.
Question number two in the name of Simon Court.
Thank you. To the Minister of Transport, does he stand by his statement, "I regularly reinforce my expectations that Waka Kotahi and other agencies spend money in a proportionate and reasonable way"? If so, in which cases, if any, has this expectation not been met?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, I certainly stand by my statement. And across the investments that Waka Kotahi makes, I am confident that the agency delivers expenditure that is responsible and delivers benefits for New Zealand through investments such as the two-laning of the previously one-lane Motu Bridge on State Highway 2 at Gisborne, the investment in the Tamaki Cycleway that we recently reopened, the investment in State Highway 5, safety improvements outside of Rotorua, and of course bringing home Transmission Gully that the previous government goofed up so badly on. Of course, across a $4.5 billion spend every year from a statutorily independent agency, there will from time to time be expenditure that is not in accordance with my expectations, and I've recently spoken about some of that expenditure across the Road to Zero program, and I continue, as other ministers do, to talk with my agencies to make sure that all expenditure is appropriate.
Supplementary. Does the minister agree that it is proportionate and reasonable to spend up to $311 million on a 4.5 kilometre shared path between Petone and Nauronga at a cost of $69,000 per metre? And is this the most expensive cycleway in New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, the Nauranga to Peteoni cycleway, which I joined with local government leaders to sign the documents on earlier this week, is one of the most keenly awaited infrastructure projects in the Wellington region. It will provide safe walking and cycling options for people to connect between Lower Hutt and Wellington City. It has been widely supported, in fact, across the House and across central and local government and across people right across this region. Our government is one that invests across a range of transport infrastructure. The old days of just investing in roads will not get us where we need to in terms of a safe, resilient and low-carbon network. I know that's the thinking of the ACT Party, but our government will make sure that all New Zealanders, including people here in Wellington, have real and safe transport choices.
Supplementary.
Is this a point of order?
Yes.
Point of order, David.
Mr. Speaker, the question was clearly about the Minister's view about the acceptability of the price of the cycleway per metre, and he did not address that at all. He just talked about the cycleway and various people's attitudes to it.
No, in my opinion, he has addressed it, and quite clearly addressed it as well. So a further supplementary?
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. Does he believe that it's proportionate and reasonable to spend $44,000 on an engineering review of two giant spinning top sculptures on the Waikato Expressway? And how much did the spinning tops themselves cost?
Mr. Speaker, I do think it's appropriate for the agency to have engineering reviews to ensure the safety of any large structures that it installs. I think it would be bizarre to suggest the Transport Agency should not do that.
Supplementary.
Supplementary, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does he think it is proportionate and reasonable for NZTA to spend $25 million on fitting out its new plush Wellington office at a cost of $2,870 per square metre? Or could any of that money have been better spent repairing the potholes peppering our highways?
Mr. Speaker, I think it is entirely reasonable for any significant delivery agency to have adequate office space for its staff. In the case of Waka Kotahi, as has been canvassed in this House and in written questions, the current two premises have to be moved on from because of the end of lease periods and earthquake requirements. The new premises has gone through a standard procurement process. And Mr. Speaker, I will stand by our government's investment in road maintenance, which has increased by 40% since we inherited government, as opposed to the previous government, which flatlined investment in roading maintenance to fund its pet projects in the transport portfolio.
Supplementary.
Simon Call.
Does he believe that it's proportionate and reasonable to have spent $337,000 on an opening ceremony for the Transmission Gully motorway? And does he agree with the Mayor of Porirua, who said that money would fill a lot of potholes?
Mr. Speaker, I think it is reasonable when these significant transport projects are finished that have had a degree of large disruption for communities to be brought together to celebrate those events. After that event, I did convey to Waka Kotahi that I believe it is important that costs are minimised as much as possible, which is why I was very pleased that for the opening event for the Waikato Expressway last week, which our government has delivered, that less than $100,000 was spent on that, which compares very favourably indeed to the $1.1 million the previous National Government spent on the Waterview Tunnel opening event.
Supplementary.
Order. Everyone knows that questions are asked in silence. Simon Call.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, does he believe that it is proportionate and reasonable for Waka Kotahi to spend taxpayer funds to research and identify Māori experiences, expectations and priorities for transport in New Zealand? And how is this more important than fixing unsafe roads for all New Zealanders?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I do believe that it is important that the transport network delivers on the aspirations and needs of all New Zealanders, and that is why Waka Kotahi has undertaken that piece of work. In respect to the second part of the member's question, as I've outlined already, under our government, the funding for road maintenance has increased by over 40% from what the previous National Act government provided when it was in office.
Supplementary. Does the Minister believe that it is proportionate and reasonable for Waka Kotahi to spend over $72 million for its share of the Let's Get Wellington Moving business case? And how is taking 3 years to prepare a $120 million business case proportionate and reasonable?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I do fully accept that the other side of the House wrote Wellington City off as a, quote, dying city when it was in government, but that is not the approach of our government. We believe that it is time to make decisive investments in a low-carbon transport network. Those were Mr. Key's comments, which that member supported at the time, I'm quite sure, even if he doesn't now. We are going to make the investments in safe walking and cycling, a high-frequency, high-capacity mass rapid transit to finally decongest the city and give Wellingtonians the transport choices that they have lacked for so many years. I understand there's a lack of ambition on that side of the House for transport in Wellington, but we're getting on with the job.
Are we ready to move on? Very good. Question number three in the name of Tangi Utukere.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment. What announcements has she made regarding He Pautama Rangatahi?
The Honourable Kāmau Sekolo.
I recently announced that funding has been approved for 9 new He Pautama Rangatahi programs across the North Island. These programs will work with 880 young people who are not in education, employment or training and are at risk of long-term benefit dependency. The government is focused on helping our rangatahi get the skills and support they need to choose a career and life pathway that gives them and their whānau a better future. We recognise that some of our rangatahi need more support than others. He Pautama Rangatahi is unique and, Mr. Speaker, it works.
Supplementary, what results have she seen from He Pautama Rangatahi?
Mr. Speaker, the basic principle of He Pautama Rangatahi is that local communities are best placed to reach our rangatahi and help them work through the barriers they face to move forward with their lives. Since it was launched by my colleague, the Honourable Willie Jackson, in 2018, 8,378 rangatahi have enrolled in the program, with only 12% having withdrawn or unenrolled. The program has also seen 3,869 rangatahi move into employment, education or training, with many more still enrolled in the program and working towards achieving their goals. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, 76% of the young people on the program are Māori, emphasising the importance of that local approach.
What other government initiatives will have an impact on people participating in He Pautama Rangatahi?
Mr. Speaker, of the 8,378 people enrolled in He Pautama Rangatahi, only 35% have a driver's licence at the time of their enrolment. We know that having a driver's licence is a basic prerequisite for up to 70% of jobs. Additionally, not having a driver's licence is frequently a young person's first interaction with the justice system. This is why the government invested $86.5 million into helping 64,000 people obtain driver's licences as part of Budget 2022. This important investment will help many people, but it will particularly help our rangatahi on their journey to achieving their full potential.
Now we come to question number four, in the name of Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does he consider that fiscal and monetary policy decisions in the past 2 years have in any way exacerbated the cost of living crisis? If so, how?
The Honourable David Parker.
The fiscal and monetary measures enacted in early 2020 were in response to a pandemic-related 1-in-100-year economic shock. This was a time of considerable uncertainty, with unemployment forecast to reach significant levels. I consider our economic response has been instrumental in the record low levels of unemployment we now have. If we did not provide that support, the economic consequences for New Zealanders were dire. In all likelihood, the households still managing the inflationary impacts of global energy prices now, many of them would also be out of work. New Zealand's response was in line with the rest of the advanced world and was generally supported by opposition parties at the time. We are now seeing tighter constraints on the supply side of the economy, and both monetary policy and fiscal policy are responding accordingly. Fiscal policy is also supporting New Zealand households through the current inflationary spike through targeted temporary support.
Supplementary. Does he agree with Arthur Grimes, former Reserve Bank chair, that the current Reserve Bank's least regrets policy on unemployment meant they were paying no attention to inflation over the past 2 years?
No, I prefer the comments in the editorial in the Dominion Post, which says the Reserve Bank of New Zealand did a credible job during the pandemic.
Who does he think knows more about monetary policy, a former chair of the Reserve Bank or the editor of the Dominion Post?
I'm sure that the former chair of the Reserve Bank knows more about monetary policy than either I do or the member does, but he would know no more about it than the current chief executive or chair of the Reserve Bank, who the Dominion judge did a creditable job.
Does he agree with former Reserve Bank Chair Arthur Grimes that the government's decision to change the Reserve Bank's focus to a dual mandate was a mistake and has helped lead to record high inflation?
No, and I would observe that the dual mandate is common overseas.
Has he seen reports that one in four New Zealanders are now struggling to make ends meet on a monthly basis? And does he acknowledge that if the Reserve Bank hadn't unleashed such a tidal wave of cash, then things could be different?
The Minister of Finance and the Prime Minister have on many occasions acknowledged cost of living pressures. I would observe that Treasury forecasts are for wage growth to exceed inflation in every one of the next 4 years, as they have in the prior years under this administration. In respect of the current pressures, of course, there is a payment on the 1st of August going to 2.1 eligible New Zealanders, which will assist with those pressures.
Does he agree with economist Dennis Wesselbaum, who says while there was way too much money put into the system by the Reserve Bank, most of the blame for the current inflation situation should be placed at the feet of the government's response?
Mr. Speaker, I would agree with Todd Muller, who on the 26th of May said, "This is a time in our history where money needs to be spent," and with Paul Goldsmith on the 11th of May 2020, who said no government could have stopped COVID-19 creating huge economic problems. Credit where credit is due, the government's speed at getting the wage subsidy scheme up and running reduced early economic calamity. And I would also agree with similar comments from Simon Bridges, who of course said that it was too little by saying that the wage subsidy had helped employees for 12 weeks, but it hasn't helped businesses with zero revenue pay overheads like rent, power and stock. I would not agree with captains of hindsight.
Will he support members of parliament from all parties except Labor to encourage Labor MPs to agree to an inquiry at the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee into the economic response to COVID-19? Or is it his position that the government did everything perfectly?
We won't be agreeing with that suggestion of a separate inquiry in addition to all of the other processes which enable inquiry into those same issues. One of the reasons why I don't think I like the National Party approach to independence of the Reserve Bank is that it of course was a former leader of the National Party, the Honourable Don Brash, who whilst head of the Reserve Bank colluded with the National Party to obtain an electable place on the Labor Party list whilst he was Governor of the Reserve Bank. Appalling practice.
Point of order,
David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, I think that sort of accusation of corruption against a member of the public, a former member of this House, and someone who does not have the ability now to defend himself in this House is exactly the sort of thing that brings this House of Representatives into disrepute. And if you'd like to uphold the reputation of the House, then I think you should ask that member to withdraw and apologise for those comments.
Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, if any member of the public who is not present in the House has an objection to something that has been said about them in the House, there is a process that they can follow.
Further speaking to the point of order, The very strong word that was used by the leader of the ACT Party was not used by me. It was his description.
Yeah. David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, the accusation was that someone in high public office used their power to gain personal political favours. If that's not an accusation of corruption, nothing is. He's now dancing on the head of a pin.
What I will say is that I listened carefully to the answer. The minister doesn't actually have responsibility for part of that answer. That's one thing. The former member is able to apply to respond to what has been said. Standing Order 160. I think every member, in my opinion, should be careful about what they say, even if we do have privilege in this House. Go on to the next question. Question number five, in the name of Glenn Bennett.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My speaker is to the Minister of Revenue and asks, how can eligible New Zealanders ensure they receive the first cost of living payment on August 1?
The Honourable David Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The government's cost of living payments are the latest step we're taking to help New Zealanders pay their bills. The first of three monthly cost of living payments is due to be made on Monday at around $116. Around 2.1 million people are eligible to receive the payment if they earned less than or $70,000 or less in the 2022 tax year and are not entitled to the winter energy payment. There is no need to apply for the payment, and it will occur automatically if Inland Revenue has the recipient's bank account details. Therefore, I'm urging people to make sure Inland Revenue has their up-to-date bank details. I encourage all eligible New Zealanders to log into MyIR on the IRD website and check their bank account details are up to date. This will ensure they receive the payment on 1st of August if they're eligible.
How many people are eligible for the cost of living payments and when will the payments be made?
Mr. Speaker, there are an estimated 2.1 million Kiwis eligible for the cost of living payment. This sits alongside the government's winter energy payment, and together these payments will support 81% of New Zealanders aged 18 and over with their bills this year. For eligible New Zealanders that have lodged their bank account details with IRD, the three main payment dates are the 1st of August, the 1st of September and the 3rd of October. Each payment is $116 roughly, totalling $350 in total. This equates to $27 a week increase in take-home income for 2.1 million New Zealanders over this three-month period.
Will people still receive the payment if they lodge their bank account details with IRD after August 1?
Mr. Speaker, we already have bank account details for 90% of those eligible, but we're seeking details for the rest. If for some reason eligible people do not get their bank account details lodged with IRD before Monday, they will still receive the $350 worth of payments if they provide bank account details at a later date. While eligible New Zealanders will have until 31 March next year to provide their bank account details, I would encourage eligible people to do this soon. It's not compulsory, but it is encouraged. Either online at ird.govt.nz through their MyIR account or by phone.
Question number six, in the name of Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing, what was Kāinga-ora's net surplus or deficit after tax for the third quarter of the 2021-22 financial year compared to forecast? And is she satisfied with the performance of Kāinga-ora?
The Honourable Pēni Henare.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I am advised that for the third quarter of the 2021-22 financial year, Kāinga-ora had an actual deficit of $13.6 million compared to a forecast deficit of $46.8 million. I am advised for the actual year to date, as at 31 March 2022, Kāinga-ora's net deficit after tax was $82 million compared to a forecasted net deficit of $115 million. This is $33 million better than forecast. In answer to the second part of the question, sir, yes.
What actions has she taken, if any, in response to the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development report to her showing that Kāinga-ora is projected to record a $662 million deficit for the 2023-24 year, and that by 2025 interest costs will be 39% of its rental cash flow for the year?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, we continue to look at the settings that can that continue to inform the work that Kāinga Ora does in the housing program of this government. What we do know, sir, is that as a result of the challenges through the pandemic, we have already changed the number of those settings, not just through Kāinga Ora, but of course some of the other schemes that allow us to, one, build more houses, and two, get more people to buy their first house. So we'll continue to monitor that as we head into the coming year and beyond, and make sure that the settings are right to make sure that we can answer the housing crisis that we're dealing with.
Why has Kāinga Ora only built 21 net new state houses in the last year?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I want to continue to push back on the assertion from that member that we've only built so few houses. The actual number is approximately 1,815 new houses in the past year ending 30 to June. And Mr. Speaker, if I can, in the primary question, the member asks about the most recent quarter of the last financial year, and I can tell that member that over 215 new net homes have been built in that period. So I continue to push back against the numbers that that member continues to persist with.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Can the Minister confirm that to build new houses, particularly where we're aiming to increase the intensity of the houses, you first have to demolish the houses that were sitting there?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I can indeed confirm that. And Mr. Speaker, as we look across the housing footprint for Kāinga Ora, as we've looked to expand the housing portfolio and the numbers of houses that we have available for people, that work is currently underway in a number of cities, and in particular in Auckland, where we see an exponential growth in houses. And of course, as I said in my previous answer, the net numbers that that member continues to persist with in this House are clearly incorrect.
This is supplementary. In relation to his remark just now about pushing back at apparently my erroneous assertion, is he saying that the government's own housing dashboard does not show that from June 2021 to May 2022, the net increase in new state houses built by Kāinga Ora is just 21 houses?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am pushing back on the numbers that that member continues to place in this House, and continue to say that this government has a strong and proud record of delivering homes.
Supplementary. Is she satisfied with Kāinga Ora spending $24 million on an office fit-out at a time when it has built just 21 net new state houses in the last year?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, the process undertaken to house Kāinga Ora saw a number of sites being brought into one in both Auckland and Wellington, and I support the work that's been done there. And also, if I can, Mr. Speaker, acknowledge the comments made by the Minister for Transport, who said that the procurement process that was undertaken to do that, I'm completely satisfied with.
Has she told her officials to only give her oral briefings on Kāinga Ora financial performance because she is worried that written briefings about Kāinga Ora get leaked to me and to the media?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, look, I can't exactly say what she has said to her officials. And with respect to the assertion made by that member about the leak, look, on this side of the House, we're focused on building homes.
Question number 7, in the name of Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Conservation. What recent announcements has she made regarding the Milford Opportunities Project?
Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Portal Williams.
Today marks the next step in the delivery of a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reshape how we do tourism in Piopio Tahi Milford Sound. The mass tourism approach of pre-COVID times, with 870,000 visitors in 2019, was putting the natural environment and infrastructure at this UNESCO World Heritage site under significant pressure. Today we have announced an impressive lineup of experts to drive the project forward, grounded in conservation and cultural values.
Supplementary. Who has been appointed to the Milford Opportunities Board, and what skills do they bring to the table?
Sorry. Can I
ask Joseph Mooney to stand, withdraw and apologise. Your conversation was so loud I did not even hear the question being asked.
Draw and apologise.
Can you...
Point
of order, David Seymour.
Mr Speaker, how can someone be asked to withdraw and apologise for being too loud but not for accusing a member of the public of corruption?
I have addressed the former issue and that is concluded. The member knows the rules. When Mr Mooney has withdrawn and apologised, David Seymour will withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise. Point of order.
Point of order, David Seymour.
Mr Speaker, I ask you to reflect on the consistency of those three rulings when you have a chance.
You can leave the chamber, please. I'll get Rachel Brooking to ask that question again.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Who has been appointed to the Milford Opportunities Board and what skills do they bring to the table?
Mr Speaker, as the jewel in the crown of New Zealand's conservation estate and arguably the eighth wonder of the world, we can't afford to get this wrong.
That's right.
That is why I'm excited to announce this impressive lineup of experts who will help drive this project. This includes Mana Whenua representatives Muriel Johnstone and Michael Skerritt, as well as Michelle Trapsky, Bill Day and Andrew Patterson, who collectively have extensive knowledge in sustainable tourism, design and management. The board will be chaired by Dr Keith Turner, who has decades of experience in economic and environmental policy. The board will also be supported by local government representatives from Southland District Council and Environment Southland.
Supplementary.
Point of order, Chris Bishop.
Mr Speaker, this question is essentially the Minister reading out board appointments, which he issued a press release about. Is this seriously what the government is using its parliamentary questions for today?
And your point of order is what?
Supplementary.
I call the Honourable Jackie Dean.
Does the Minister intend that the Milford airstrip be closed as part of this process?
Mr Speaker, we are now engaged in a feasibility process which is being managed by the Board and the project manager, who will soon be appointed. As part of the master plan, that is a feature that the board and a project leader will be looking at. However, as government, we will wait until we see the results and the report from the project before we make any decisions.
Supplementary. What are the other next steps for the project?
Thank you. With the Ministerial Advisory Board in place and the Milford Opportunities Project Unit being established, they will undertake the feasibility testing of the master plan recommendations, including getting feedback from key stakeholders and international visitors.
Question number 8 in the name of Penny Simmons.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, does he agree with comments made by the former Chief Executive of the Otago Polytechnic, Phil Kerr, about the government's polytechnic reform that, quote, not a single dollar has been put into improving outcomes for learners, not a single dollar to strengthening the regional providers, and so the issues that we had before Mr Hipkins started this misguided venture are not only still there, they're worse. End of quote.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, I respect Phil Kerr and I do recognise his considerable contribution to vocational education in New Zealand, and I respectfully disagree with him. I note that he was not a fan of the vocational education reforms from the beginning. The model of vocational education that we had in New Zealand wasn't sustainable and it wasn't delivering the skills that our employers are crying out for. And we hear examples of that every single day with employers complaining that they cannot get access to the skilled labour that they need. That is a sign that our vocational education system has been under-delivering for New Zealand for a long time, not to mention the fact that most of our polytechs were in a great degree of financial difficulty that was getting worse. I absolutely reject the assertion that additional funding hasn't gone to improving outcomes for learners, particularly coming from the National Party, who are arguing we're spending too much money.
Supplementary. Has the Minister seen further comments by Phil Kerr, quote, "You can't address the problems of the magnitude we have in the sector at the moment without redundancies," end of quote. And does the Minister consider those redundancies should occur at the head office of Te Pūkenga, where there are no teaching staff, or out in the polytechnics?
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes.
Further supplementary. Does the Minister agree with the statement in the 2018 Government-commissioned ITP Roadmap 2020, which stated, "Examination of economies and mergers suggest that few, if any, recurrent savings result"? And if so, why did the Minister then proceed with the merger of the polytechnics and industry training organisations, which has only caused disarray and a significantly larger deficit?
In answer to the first part of the question, no. And with regard to the second part of the question, the member is wrong in her assertion. The deficits that the polytechs are producing at the moment, or that the consolidated polytechs are producing at the moment, are actually lower than some of the projected deficits that we were expecting to see without reform.
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Supplementary, can the Minister confirm that when we came into government, the state of the polytech sector was such that not only were they not delivering on trainees and tradespeople that we needed, but that their financial situation was dire to the point where a cheque had to be written out for $33 million to save Taipitini Polytech on the West Coast from absolute failure and disaster?
Mr Speaker, I can confirm that, and I can confirm that Taipitini were not the only ones. In fact, Unitech would have had to completely shut its doors had the government not stepped in and provided them with the cash flow they needed to keep operating on a day-to-day basis. Welltech and Fitzroy were in a great degree of financial difficulty, and if we'd not intervened there, the capital city would have lost its polytech provision as well. Those are just some examples, and in fact the situation was continuing to get worse for the majority of our polytechs.
Supplementary. Why did the Minister write on the recently released TC monitoring report on Te Pūkenga, quote, "I'd like to see a plan for some early wins, re-network efficiencies, ASAP," end of quote. And isn't this because all he has achieved to date is disarray and a significantly larger deficit?
No, Mr Speaker, it recognises the fact that enrolments at Te Pūkenga have declined significantly this year, and they do need to make sure they are responding to that, as they would have had to do, regardless of whether or not Te Pūkenga had been established.
Supplementary. Which of the following statements does the Minister consider best describes Te Pūkenga, his mega merger of the vocational education sector? Phil Kerr's comments, quote, "Simply an ego trip on the Minister's part," end of quote, or Merin Davis's comment, quote, "Everyone is in Disneyland."
Mr Speaker, neither of the above. And in fact, the two people that the members quoted have almost opposite concerns about the process. Phil Kerr was opposed to the process from the beginning. Merin Davis was in favour of the process at the beginning, and in fact was concerned that not enough progress was being made fast enough.
Question number 9, in the name of the Honourable Julianne Genta.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he stand by his statement, "The time for fine words on climate change is over. We actually need to start the transition"? If so, how does the government's transport policy reflect this?
The Honourable Michael Wolff.
Mr Speaker, yes, I do. I stand by my full statement that, quote, "Getting more Kiwis into clean cars is the hugely important part of reducing our emissions. The time for fine words on climate change is over. We actually need to start the transition." And the good news is that we are making progress. The clean car discount has seen more than 57,000 light electric and non-plug-in hybrid vehicles registered, resulting in significant emissions reductions across cars coming into New Zealand, with a roughly tripling of the numbers of zero emissions vehicles month on month and a 15% reduction in the emissions intensity of new vehicles coming in. Combined with other measures, including the government's $1.2 billion climate emergency response fund, this means that across transport, the government is on track to meet its first carbon budget under the emissions reduction plan.
Supplementary, what is the precise increase in carbon emissions from the government's over $1 billion fuel tax cut as determined by the climate implications of policy assessment?
Mr. Speaker, the advice that I have been provided is that the total possible impact on emissions that is modelled is between 0.7 and 1.2% as a result of that particular policy. Now, of course, our overall goal is to continue reducing emissions, and that's why it's important to note that we remain on track across transport to reach our emissions reduction targets in the first carbon budget period. But in this case, the government did believe it was very important to provide critical support to Kiwi families facing those cost of living pressures. And of course, we have also balanced up that investment with half-price public transport.
Well done. Wouldn't spending over $1 billion on targeted support for people who are struggling with larger cash payments or benefit increases be of more help to them and the climate than fossil fuel subsidies that also benefit rich people, petrol companies, and hurt the climate?
Mr. Speaker, of course the government has made investments across that whole spectrum. We have made the investment to ensure that people do not are buffered from the increase in petrol prices that have been experienced. We have made the investment in half-price public transport, and while it's not in my portfolio area, we have in fact made investments via direct payments to people below the median income, which will be starting to come into effect from early August.
Why is the government spending more than $1 billion on fossil fuel tax cuts when it could not find $360 million in budget 2022 to fund hybrid electric trains to preserve and increase interregional rail services that reduce our dependency on fossil fuels?
Mr. Speaker, because in any budget the government always has choices to make about the investments that it might wish to make. In budget 2022, I note that $1.2 billion was invested through the Climate Emergency Response Fund, including hundreds of millions of dollars in building a more resilient rail network, including a $350 million transport choices package to help more Kiwis access public transport and safe walking and cycling options. And we continue to work with Greater Wellington Regional Council around their proposals for improved rail services, as the member reflects on in her question.
Well done.
Can he confirm the Infrastructure Commission review of the evidence produced for Let's Get Welly Moving in early May said that option 4, not option 1 as the government has announced, was the best choice from both a climate and economic perspective?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that Te Waihanga made that assessment based on the base urban development cases that were presented at that stage, and that the preferred option of option 1 that the government, that Cabinet selected, was based on a significantly higher model of urban intensification to ensure that there were greater carbon reduction benefits achieved.
What is the date and title of the advice he's just referred to about increased intensification from option 1, and why was it not provided to the Infrastructure Commission before they undertook their review?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have the precise date and title to hand, but I'm happy to provide it to the member. I'm referring to advice that Cabinet received to inform its decision-making at the time that it did.
Question number 10, Shannon Halbert.
Ae te māngai o te whare, tēnā koe. Question to the Minister of Transport. What recent announcements has the government made about supporting public transport users?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, the government recently announced an extension to cost of living support for Kiwi commuters through the extension of half-price public transport and continued reductions to fuel excise duty and road user charges. The cut to fuel excise reduces the cost of filling up a 40-litre tank of petrol by over $11 and for a 60-litre tank over $17. And half-price public transport sees an average person who pays two $5 fares a day save $25 a week. Inflation is rising across the world, and cost of living pressures are making it tough for New Zealanders right now. As a government, we continue to recognise and respond to the level of need, and in this case, I'm very pleased that we're particularly able to support those New Zealanders with the increased transport costs they face.
Well done.
Supplementary. How is the cost of living support consistent with the government's response to the climate crisis?
Mr. Speaker, it is important that the transition to a low emissions, high productivity economy is fair and equitable for all New Zealanders. By reducing the cost barrier for using public transport, we're demonstrating a commitment to providing New Zealanders with more options for how they live, work and move around. In doing so, we're providing more opportunities to embrace mode shift and to tackle the climate crisis head on by making a dent in our transport emissions. And I received very good feedback when I was on using the buses in Christchurch last week, Mr. Brownlee, when everyone was enjoying those half-price public transport fares.
Supplementary. What continued support will the government provide to promote increased use of public transport?
Mr. Speaker, from the beginning of February, Community Connect will be available nationwide and permanently, enabling those people with community services cards to access half-price public transport. This will mean around about 1 million Kiwis will have access to cheaper transport, and it will also help us to reach our climate change targets. This is a government committed to investing in accessible, affordable and convenient public transport services right across New Zealand.
Well done. Well done.
Simon Watts, question number 11.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Local Government, does she agree with the Prime Minister's statement that it will not be the policy of any government I lead to embark on another substantial reform of local government or governance unless it is sought and unless there is broad consensus amongst local government about the need for and the direction of change, end quote. If so, does she believe there is broad consensus amongst local government on her Three Waters reform?
The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I absolutely agree with the Prime Minister's statement in the context in which it was given. On the second part of the question, I draw the Member's attention to the statement from LGNZ on the 25th of July, which said, quote, "The local government sector has been advocating for water reforms for decades. While each council will have their own view on the proposed model, everyone is unified on the need for reforms of some kind. LGNZ is committed to a pragmatic approach to the reforms because we know if reforms don't go through now, it will be back to the political too hard basket," end of quote.
If the government is committed to only undertake reform of local government unless it is sought, why won't she allow councils to opt out of her Three Waters proposal instead of legislating a compulsory transfer of water assets?
Mr. Speaker, this reform has been taking place over at least the last 4.5 years. And once the economic modelling had shown the huge cost burden that would weigh down on councils who have reached their debt ceiling limits, that was the point at which it was just unsustainable to accept the status quo, and an opt-out model would not provide a way forward for councils.
Why has advertising for executive positions in the water services entities already begun before a single submission on the bill has been heard?
Mr. Speaker, because momentum is taking place and councils want certainty that there is a transition plan to successfully ensure that once the water service entities are stood up, there is movement already in place to ensure successful implementation.
So what does she say to the people who submitted on Three Waters, expecting their voices to be heard, only to see decisions like appointing executives are already being made?
That there is a plan in place and that it's really important to ensure successful transition towards the water reform that we are proposing.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Kieran McInaughty.
To the Minister, what advice has she received on the impact on ratepayers, especially rural ratepayers, if reform is not followed through in water services?
That the burden of cost will fall to ratepayers, and especially in rural provincial areas, ratepayers will be it will be too unaffordable for them. We need to find a different way forward. That's what this government is doing, rather than accepting the status quo that the opposition is promoting.
Supplementary. What will she do to reassure New Zealanders their voices will be heard on Three Waters, and that this won't be a repeat of the consultations with councils, which took place after Cabinet had already made decisions behind closed doors.
The bill currently before the Select Committee enables the public to have a successful conversation around what the reforms are promoting. They will be heard. The Select Committee is going to be engaging with the great number of submitters who have already proposed their views around the reforms.
Barbara Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is the Minister aware that the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee has plans to travel throughout the country to hear submissions on the Three Waters Entities Bill?
I am, and I support fully the parliamentary process to go out and engage with the public and hear the submitters and their views on this particular set of proposed changes.
Question number 12, in the name of Dr. Nai
My question is to the Minister for Youth. What recent announcements has she made about Youth Parliament?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Mr. Speaker, recently I announced the commencement of the 10th Youth Parliament. While this is a six-month programme, the 2 days that participants spend here in Parliament is a crucial component of that and often cited as a highlight. Last week, almost 140 young people aged between 16 and 23 travelled to Wellington to participate in mock debates, caucus meetings, select committees and oral question time. These were all our youth MPs, youth press gallery members and for the first time ever, a youth clerk. I just want to recognise the contribution of the young people who travelled from across the motu, members from across this house who supported them, press gallery and the staff from the Ministry of Youth Development and the Office of the Clerk for the tremendous effort that collectively has been put into making Youth Parliament 2022 a success.
Supplementary. Why is Youth Parliament such an important event?
Mr. Speaker, I've met many young people who are incredibly passionate about a number of issues that impact them. Youth Parliament gives them the opportunity to better understand how Parliament processes works and for their views to be heard by decision makers, other young people and the general public. It's an excellent way to encourage an apolitical civic engagement with youth across the motu. I've met with many of them while they were here, listened to their speeches, and Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to report that the future of our democracy looks bright.
Supplementary. What has the Minister heard about the diversity of this year's Youth Parliament?
Mr. Speaker, from the start I wanted us to collectively ensure that young people from a range of diverse backgrounds had the opportunity to be part of Youth Parliament. This year's Youth Parliament was one of, if not the most diverse Youth Parliament in the event's 30-year history, with around 35% of participants either Māori or Pacifica, 23% identifying with an ethnic community, 48% female, and 6% identifying as gender diverse. This is an increase all round from Youth Parliament held in 2019. And I understand from conversations with the Minister for Diversity, Inclusion and Ethnic Communities, she was also very pleased with the diversity of this event.
Our members, that concludes oral questions.